some of you who might be less familiar with Peter Singer might be thinking, what was Kat's comment about earlier? He's the godfather of EA. Who's this guy? Okay, so he gave a TED talk recently, which you might have come across, about the effect of activism movement. But he's been involved for ages. He basically kickstarted this whole thing for a lot of people. I've met so many people who have said that, you know, how did, when I ask them how they started off, what's their EA story, a lot of them say, oh, I read Peter Singer. And it's the same for me as well. And when I first started out, I was just looking for fellow Peter Singer fans. Like, there was no term EA. I didn't know about any, a lot of these groups didn't exist. And so he was like the core of who I was looking for. So for decades, Peter's been writing about like animal ethics. He's often called like the founding father of the founding father. That's a date on it. The founder of the animal rights movement. And he's been writing about global poverty. And now in his talks about effective altruism, he often says, you know, I've been writing about this for a while, and it's only just in the past few years that this has kicked off. So he's got a lot to thank you guys for. And I'm sure you've got a lot to thank him for as well. So I bet you're all very excited to meet each other. And just a final thing, I remembered a quote that I heard once from a Christian as a warning to another Christian who said, be careful, you'll like him. He's just a lovely guy. Okay, so with that, I give you...
Thank you very much for that generous introduction, which I caught most of. I'm very happy to be in touch with you this way. I'm sorry I couldn't be there in San Francisco with you, but it's a long way away, obviously, from where I am now. So I'm not quite sure what you've already been talking about. I understand that you've been talking about effective altruism over the weekend, and I don't quite know what you've already said. So that's one disadvantage of just coming in this way, that I may go over things that you already know and may not pick up on some themes that I would have liked to pick up. But for that reason, we have about an hour, maybe an hour and 5 or 10 minutes. I'd like to just talk for a relatively short part of that, and then I want you to ask questions or make comments so that we have a discussion, so you can tell me what are the things that you want to hear from me or want to get my views on while we have this chance to talk. And I'd also like to hear from you about what your interests are where you feel the effective altruism movement is going, because I do think that it's something new and exciting, but very much still forming, and therefore, at an early stage of the movement, you have a chance to contribute to its direction in a way that's quite significant. I'll talk a little bit about building the movement and some of the issues that you might want to think about in regard to that in a few moments as part of what I want to say. So let me begin by saying, and you may well have had this, I think that effective altruism is a new movement which essentially combines the two elements that you'd expect from the name. It combines the idea of helping others, altruism, and the idea of doing that effectively or in the most effective way that you can. So another way of expressing it would be to say it's about trying to make the world a better place, but it's about not just trying to make the world better, but trying to make the world as much better as you can, given the limits on your resources, whatever they might be, or perhaps you could say given the limits on your altruism, because very, very few, if any, are 100% altruistic. I certainly don't consider myself to be anything like that. I spend time doing things that are not directed towards making the world as good as possibly can, but with the time and money and other resources that I do devote to that, I want them to be as effective as possible. I don't want them just to make some sort of difference. I want them to make the biggest possible difference where I can do that. So that's what I think the movement is about. In one sense, you might say, well, what's really new about that? We've had charities for a very long time. We've had people giving time and money to trying to improve things. That's certainly true. But the emphasis on doing that effectively is, I think, something that is relatively new, not completely new. And the idea that this ought to be a part of everyone's life, I think, is also something that is, again, not totally new, but at least neglected, quite severely neglected in recent decades. So what I mean by that is the ethic that is still most broadly accepted out there in the community is that what's really important in living ethically is that we don't violate certain rules, that we don't cheat, steal, kill, maim, those sorts of things. I think effective altruism has a different view that says that if you want to live ethically, it's important that you use at least some of your time and resources to make the world better. So it's trying to say that if you're going to be living an ethical life, you need to be doing something reasonably significant to make the world a better place. Assuming that is, of course, that you have the resources to do that. So if, you know, if we were talking about everyone in the world, you might say, well, this doesn't really apply to a lot of people. They have to spend all of their effort simply to feed themselves or to look after their family. But effective altruism is really addressed to people who do have extra resources beyond what is required to meet their basic needs. So it's primarily addressed to the billion or so affluent people in the world who have much more than enough to meet our own basic needs, and in fact are spending a lot of time and a lot of resources on things that are in no sense meeting our needs, but are luxuries or frivolities of one sort or another. So that's why I think effective altruism makes a difference to the prevailing morality that's out there. Although you could easily say, for instance, especially if you're a Christian or if you're talking to Christians to try to persuade them to be part of this movement, you could easily say that it's going back to the message of the Gospels and indeed the message of the earlier Christian church, which you know, you can find plenty of statements saying things like to feed the hungry if you have an abundance is not simply an optional thing to do, but is a duty. That in fact, in views like Thomas Aquinas, that you don't actually have a right to property that is in abundance against somebody else who is starving. So if you have more food than you need and someone is starving and that person takes your food, they're not even stealing. They're just taking what they have a natural right to. So, yeah, you can find these sorts of ideas going back a long way, but certainly, as you would know, living in the world today, most people don't think that, and so it's really important that we put that message out to people to try to change that idea, to try and say, look, it's really important not just to do no harm, but to do good. And in fact, in some cases, that may be more important than doing no harm if you do a much greater good. So let me say a little bit, since I come at this from an ethics perspective, obviously there's different ways of coming at this, let me say a little bit about some of the values that are part of this movement that lie behind it, and you can think about these and think about whether you agree with them or don't agree with them and to what extent. And there's a little summary of those, by the way, in a blog that Holden Karnofsky has on the GiveWell website. I presume most of you have heard of GiveWell by now. If not, you certainly should be spending some time at givewell.org, website that assesses charities relating to helping the global poor, but also has a lot of other interesting discussion. And this was a blog that Holden put up on the 4th of April of this year called Deep Value Judgments and Worldview Characteristics. And essentially, I agree with the kinds of things that he's talking about. I think we share a lot of values. So he says people involved in effective altruism are cosmopolitan or global humanitarians. That is, we're generally not concerned particularly to do good in the immediate area where we're living or in some other particular segment or slice of humanity that we might identify with, you know, people of my ethnic group or my religion or whatever it might be. We're concerned to do good generally. Now, it may be that you feel that you can do more good locally because you know much better about what's going to happen there and what will make a difference. That's an empirical question. That's possible. But it's not because they're people in your community. It would have to be because your dollars actually somehow do more good there than they do elsewhere. But generally speaking, I think, of course, that's not the case, given the huge differences in wealth between where we live and where some of the world's poorest people live. So effective altruism is cosmopolitan or globally humanitarian. Another critical value judgment, obviously, would be that things like suffering and premature death are bad. They're the kinds of things that typically we might want to prevent. And there's a lot that you could say about how you compare those two. Suffering, I guess, something that pretty much we would all agree is bad in itself. Of course, sometimes it might be worth going through some suffering in order to achieve a greater good or to reduce suffering overall, but just considered in itself, suffering is a bad thing. And premature death generally, especially at least of beings who want to go on living or having good lives, happy or worthwhile lives, is also a bad thing. Not to say that premature death is always a bad thing if, for instance, it's the only way of stopping irremediable suffering, but generally it's a bad thing. A third thing is that I said we're global humanitarians, but I should perhaps have said we're not only concerned about human well-being either, we're also concerned to some extent about the well-being of non-humans who are capable of suffering, conscious beings, which essentially means in the state of the world as we know it, non-human animals. We would be concerned about conscious aliens from another galaxy if we knew about their existence or could affect them, but we don't. So practically this means we're concerned about animal suffering too. There's some differences, I guess, I don't know anyone in the effective altruism movement who really says, I don't think animal suffering matters at all, but there are certainly a lot of people who say it doesn't matter as much as the suffering of humans, and that's another discussion that's definitely worth having, how you compare the suffering of humans and non-human animals, and there might well be debate about whether the deaths of non-human animals is something that matters in itself. Those are further issues to talk about, but it does matter in some way. Next, and this might also be controversial, but it's one of the things that Holden puts out there. He suggests that things like justice, equality, and fairness are not intrinsically important. That's not to say they're not important. It might be very important to have a fair distribution of goods. We have to define what we mean by fair or just, of course, or equal. It might be very important to have it in terms of producing a society in which people feel that they're respected and valued, and it might also lead to the greatest overall utility if you distribute things fairly. But we're not concerned, for instance, typically about achieving equality as such. And it's important to remember that because often, especially if you're talking about an issue like reducing global poverty, and especially if you're talking about that in the United States, people are very quick to jump to the conclusion that somehow you want to redistribute all of their wealth and you're some kind of socialist who wants to produce complete equality. And that's a caricature which obviously makes it easy for people of a certain political persuasion to dismiss what you're saying. But generally that's not the case. If we're concerned about global poverty, it's because we're concerned about suffering and premature death being bad, and we might be able to deal with that and reduce that very dramatically, a long way short of achieving equality or even what some people might think of as a just or a fair distribution. So that's in harmony with essentially saying that the values of effective altruism are to a significant degree consequentialist. So we're concerned about the consequences of what we're doing. And obviously if we talk about trying to make the biggest possible change for the better in the world, that's a consequentialist claim. Now, some people will then say, well, so does that mean that you're utilitarians? And then, just as with words like socialist, a lot of people have a whole lot of negative connotations about the term utilitarian that would mean that they would rush to find some implications of what you're saying that would clash with their intuitions or perhaps with your intuitions and would be a reason for not being an effective altruist. So you can obviously be a complete consequentialist. I'm a utilitarian in my philosophy. Utilitarianism is a name for one particular variety of consequentialism. And I think that that's defensible, but it takes a fair amount of philosophical discussion to show that. And you can certainly say that, I think I want to make the world a better place as far as I can, but I think that there are some basic constraints on what you're justified in doing in order to make the world a better place. So, for instance, you could say, I would never kill an innocent person just to make the world better in some ways, even if that saved a larger number of lives or reduced suffering by a very large extent. You can certainly still be an effective altruist and recognize some constraints on what you would be willing to do, what you think would be right to do along those lines. But generally, one of the things about thinking in consequentialist terms is that you do want to maximize expected value. You do want to maximize what you can bring about or what you probably bring about given what you're going to do. And you're not so focused on things like do no harm or simply saying, well, you know, make sure you do some good. Those are generally not enough. So that's relevant in a number of the questions that get discussed in effective altruism. You're probably aware that there's a view around that one of the good things you can do as an effective altruist is get a job where you're going to earn a lot of money so that you have a lot of money to give away. It's put forward by Will McCaskill on the website 80,000 Hours, and it just recently has been written about quite a bit because of a Wall Street Journal article followed up by the David Brooks New York Times column and a number of other pieces on that. So some people will say, look, if you're going to go into banking, let's say, in order to earn a lot of money to give away a lot of money, you're going to be complicit in harming people. Your bank is going to invest in projects that are going to harm some people and somewhere or other along the line. So that's a reason why you shouldn't do it. Well, I think there is the consequentialist answer to that is partly, well, if I don't take the job, will the harm still occur anyway? And if so, then does it really make a difference whether it comes through me in some sense or comes through someone else? And if conversely, if I don't take the job, there won't be a substantial amount of money going to save lives and prevent suffering or do other good things, then the trade-off is worth it. You know, it's not a matter for me of saying, well, I've got to have clean hands. I've got to make sure that evil doesn't come through me. It's rather a matter of saying, what can I do that will make the biggest positive difference? And although, you know, I think one needs to be cautious, and as I said before, it's quite proper to have certain limits on what you would want to go, you know, how far you would want to go with that, and you need to be careful that you don't get corrupted by the culture that you're working with. I think that it's reasonable to say that you're more focused on doing the most, the greatest amount of net good than you're focused on the more absolutist or deontological rule that says you must not do harm or you must not be complicit in doing harm. So those are some of the, as I say, some of the, seem to me to be the basic values behind the movement, and I think they're broad enough to be shared by people from a wide variety of philosophical positions, and for instance, there are people in the effective altruism movement who come from a completely secular background, and there are people who come from religious backgrounds of various kinds, and I think that the movement is certainly open to all of that. Now, I wanted to say a little bit, as I said in my introduction, about building a movement and the way in which we ought to think about doing that, because this is something relatively new, and also because this is a suggestion from Jeff, actually, when we were emailing about what I might talk about, because I've had some experience in building movements, not just in this one, which, as I say, has only recently really become a movement, and in which I certainly haven't had a sort of detailed hands-on role in that to a great extent, although I'm working with the Life You Can Save to turn that into an organization. But going back to the 1970s, I was involved in the animal movement through writing Animal Liberation. And there, since there was no radical animal movement, there was no People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals or any other animal liberation or animal rights groups around really at the time, I did get involved in setting up a number of organizations and so had some experience, I guess, in building a movement there. And there are a number of things one can say about that. Firstly, I think you have to decide who you're trying to get to join. And for that reason, it's useful to have different organizations that have different kinds of pitches to people. So just to give one example, as I mentioned, I've been involved with The Life You Can Save, which in fact was developed from the book that I wrote with that title, and then the website that was set up to go with the book. And there's a very similar movement called Giving What We Can. And you might say, well, is there any point in having both of these movements out there, both of them organizing local groups or chapters, both of them concerned with encouraging people to give to relieve global poverty? And I think the answer to that is that they do have somewhat different pitches, and I think there is value in having them both. I think that Giving What We Can makes a minimum demand that people pledge to give 10% of their income to effective organizations fighting global poverty. And that means, I think, inevitably, that it's going to be, at least for a while, somewhat limited in the number of people who are prepared to make that pledge, to say, I'm going to give, the idea is to give for the rest of your life, at least 10% of what I earn to relieving global poverty. On the other hand, those who are part of that tend to be people who are very highly committed, people who are willing to work for the organization as well, to volunteer and so on, has significant appeal to student groups and is mostly organized around campus groups. The Life You Can Save has a more flexible kind of pledge because it's a pledge that starts out, you know, like a tax scale, starts out very low, suggests 1% and then goes up from there, depending how much you earn. And we're even now, after some discussions, we're putting up a suggestion that, well, if you feel that the percentage that relates to your income is too much, start somewhere and gradually work up, kind of achieve your personal best or surpass your personal best and keep working up idea. So we're much more consciously making it easier for people to get started. And therefore, we hope to have a larger number of people, and we do have a much larger number of people who've taken this, the pledge that we offer on the website. And we're hoping to become more of a kind of mass movement. So I think there's definitely scope for those sorts of differences. But the important thing is that we cooperate where we can, we work together. There's not in any sense a rivalry, let alone any kind of antagonism between us. We just see ourselves as complementary. And in fact, we're both part of the Center for Effective Altruism, which is a kind of, umbrella organizational structure for what we're doing, particularly in the United Kingdom. So I think that that's an important thing to recognize, to go with the attitude that, yes, there are going to be a number of diverse organizations in the field. Sometimes I might think there's a bit of duplication and a bit of unnecessary work that goes on with this. You know, each organization has to apply for its charitable status. Each organization advertises events. So I think what's important is that you recognize that you're all in the same field, that you're working in a well-intentioned way for the same sorts of goals, and that you cooperate wherever you can to save those duplications, to avoid incurring unnecessary costs. I don't think you need to be troubled by the fact that there are a lot of different organizations out there with different ways of going about it. And something that relates to that, I guess, a bit is the way in which you put your message. So I think from the sorts of things that are said among effective altruists and the sorts of things that you can see on discussion boards and comments and so on, there are a wide range of views about the kind of issues that we ought to be talking about and or that we ought to be focusing on and putting our resources into. And I think that also has an effect on the extent to which we can hope to attract a reasonably wide public. So, as you've noticed just from the examples I've been giving in the time I've been talking now, I've put a lot of my examples and my writing focuses on reducing global poverty. And I do that in part because I do think reducing global poverty is a highly effective thing to do. I think the expected utility of donating money to effective organizations that are working to reduce global poverty or to save the lives of people who are extremely poor and whose lives can be saved very cheaply compared to the cost of saving lives in developed countries, or providing them with better agricultural techniques or education or whatever else it might be, that these are things that are highly cost effective. So I do that on the basis of what I think is good information about what's a very reasonable choice to make. In other words, if you go into effective altruism and you say, this is what I want to do, I think it's hard to argue that that's the wrong choice in terms of your time and dollars. But it's also, and this is not an accident, it's also a choice that resonates with a broader public. I mean, it's pretty easy for people to understand that children die from preventable diseases like malaria or diarrhea or pneumonia in developing countries that they would not die of if they were living in a developed country, and that we can reduce the number of deaths of children from those diseases we can argue about how much, but anyway, not huge amounts of money, much less than we pay to save lives in our country, and that's a good thing to do. Or to prevent somebody going blind, for instance, that's a good thing to do, and we can do that reasonably cheaply. Or to prevent a young girl having her life ruined by having an obstetric fistula, once you know what that's about. These are things that grab people and help to bring them to the idea that, yes, they ought to be doing something positive with the resources that they have to improve the world. And I think you can contrast that with some of the other things that are also reasonable, defensible goals for objective altruism. So, for example, you can think about existential risk, and you can think about the sorts of discussions that the people involved with Singularity have. But if you start to talk to the person you happen to be sitting next to on a Greyhound bus when traveling to a conference or somewhere, you start talking to them about, well, you know, don't you think we should put resources into trying to prevent artificial life being malevolent, artificial intelligence, sorry, being malevolent and taking us over, I think you're much less likely to get a positive response than if you talk to them about, don't you think it would be good to save the lives of children who are dying of malaria in developing countries. So I think you need to be aware of that in thinking about, if you like, what's the public face of effective altruism. I think you need to be, you know, there's a danger always when you're mixing with other people who think like you do of being in a kind of ghetto where you think that the rest of the world is like the way you are. And that's very often not the case. I've seen the same thing happen in the animal movement where you know, people, I think, have had unrealistic objectives about what we might achieve because they've been talking to people who think like them and who are, you know, think it's as obvious as they do that the suffering we inflict on animals is wrong and unjustifiable and that nobody needs to do it and, you know, nobody needs to eat meat and therefore why don't we all change and so on. I think it's really good to get out into, as I say, you know, just the random public, the person you're sitting next to on a bus or, you know, whatever else, other ways you might like to do that, put it out somewhere on the internet but not on a website that's only being read by people who look at this stuff, and see what kind of reactions you get. So I think that's important, and some of the discussions we have on some of those other questions like existential risk, I think can get very far removed from where people are at. So I'm not saying that these aren't important things that ought to be talked about somewhere. I'm not even saying that we shouldn't try to get people to think about this at a public level. And in fact, that can and does happen. And we want to start moving some of these other things that are now pretty fringe so that they eventually start to be things that we can talk about and accept. And some of the questions within existential risk, I think, are easier for people to grapple with. If you say, look, you know, there's a danger that a large asteroid could collide with the Earth and wipe out all human beings or even all life on Earth. And there are ways in which we could not only find out whether, you know, predict that whether that's going to happen or not, but develop rockets that could deflect the asteroid enough to so that it doesn't collide. You know, that's something that people can relate to, and I think that's something that people can say, well, yeah, you know, we ought to be doing something like that, or we ought to put some resources into that. The government ought to put some resources into that, and it is, in fact, you know, looking at some of those things. So there's a whole spectrum of stuff out there. Similarly, I think in the animal movement, you know, it's the kind of thing, if you want to get the public involved, you can talk, obviously, people always were talking, I guess, about suffering to dogs and cats because people relate to that. But most of the suffering that we inflict on animals isn't to dogs and cats. It's, well, anyway, much more of it is to pigs and chickens, factory-farmed animals. So I think you can get people's sympathy for that. It's harder and it's probably easier for pigs than it is for chickens. But you can get people's sympathy for that and you can start talking to it and you can start to move the factory farming issues to the mainstream. And I think the animal movement has been successful in doing that over the 40 years or so that I've been involved with it. It has made factory farming something that far more people know about and far more people are ready to agree is a bad thing. On the other hand, some of the people in the EA movement are now talking about things like the suffering of insects. And if insects do suffer, then there's such a vast number of insects out there that it's conceivable that the suffering of insects is greater than the suffering of all vertebrates. But, you know, how do we know whether insects can suffer? There's sort of philosophical questions about that and what will we do to prevent it? Again, I think it's not a good thing to be the public face of the animal movement or the public face of EA. It's something that people can talk about and maybe one day we'll get a better handle on whether insects can suffer people will be ready, you know, once we don't inflict so much unnecessary suffering on mammals and birds and other vertebrates, people will perhaps be ready for thinking about whether insects suffer and whether there's something we ought to do about that. But I don't think that time has come. I think we're actually just starting to get some attention towards fish, which was something that, again, when I got involved with the animal movement, you couldn't really talk to people about fish. You know, they were cold and slimy, and they don't make any noises like dogs or pigs do when you hurt them. So people didn't seem to relate to them very much. So those are some of the things about how to build a movement that I think are worth thinking about. I do think it's important to get out there and to get effective altruism better known, to talk to more people there, to talk to people who are to some extent altruistic. I think part of the market for developing a larger EA movement is people who have the A part but not the E part. There's lots of people who say, oh, I give to charity. And then you say, so, you know, what do you give to? And then they say, well, you know, there's some relative of mine, somebody in the family died of cancer, so I give to the local cancer hospital. And, you know, once you get to that, you can say, well, you know, that's nice, but do you know how much we spend to save a life in this country? Can be hundreds of thousands, can be millions of dollars. And do you know that there are diseases that we know how to cure, where we can, in developing countries, where we can save lives for $1,000 or $2,000 perhaps, rather than hundreds of thousands or millions? And don't you think that saving a life is good wherever it happens? So those are the kinds of discussions I think that you can have. People who are giving from the warmth of their heart, but not really thinking very much about it. And I see that as part of the audience that we have for our message. But I do think also we can bring other people into the movement by emphasizing the effectiveness part. In my conversations with people who are not giving, a lot of it is because they think that it's not going to do any good. A lot of people have negative views about charities. You hear people saying something like, oh, it'll all get swallowed up by the administrative costs, or if you're talking about helping people in developing countries, it'll all go to corrupt governments. I think there's plenty of evidence that that's wrong, you can certainly find charities that are making an effective difference by the most rigorous kind of scrutiny, the kind of scrutiny that GiveWell does. And I think people need to know about this. It's unfortunate that there are some charities that are not effective, but in a way it's irrelevant. I mean, it's a pity that people give the money, but to somebody who's thinking about shall I give or shall I not give, it's irrelevant, because obviously you don't want them to give to the ineffective charities anyway. All that's necessary is that there is one effective charity that they can give to. And I think that's something that you can clearly demonstrate. So I want to wind up so that you have time for the questions and discussion I mentioned. Just let me say that the other thing I think that we ought to be doing is talking openly about what we're doing and about what other people in the EA movement are doing. That is giving examples of people who are doing great things, because there's lots of psychological evidence that people are more likely to help somebody if they see other people helping. You can do it in the kinds of experiments that psychology researchers set up with stooges there, and if there are stooges who rush to help, then the person who's not doesn't really know that this is a fake accident will go to help. If the stooges just sit around and go on with looking at their cell phones or whatever, the person who doesn't really know that what's going on is likely to not help either. And it's the same, I think, in this area. If you talk about what you're doing, you talk about the fact that you're giving money away, you talk about that you're helping, doing research to make it effective, you talk about people who are earning more in order to give more, if that's one of the things that you're interested in doing, I think it makes the whole thing more acceptable. And I think it's part of what will be necessary for us to develop a critical mass where we start to see a lot of people moving into effective altruism and making a really big difference to the world. So let me leave it at that. And I look forward to hearing from you in terms of what your questions and comments and interests are.
And if it's clear, then he'll just respond, and if not, I'll repeat the question into the microphone.
Okay.
Did you hear that?
No, I didn't really hear anything. It was just a little study, so you're going to have to repeat. The girls come forward.
Hi, can you hear me okay?
Now I can hear you, yes, that's good.
All right, you mentioned net good. I'm just wondering what you mean by that. Is that lack of human suffering, or just lack of suffering? Or is that maximization of quality of life? Or is it something else?
So, I think that, this is my sort of utilitarian, simple, a little crude utilitarian definition of good is that it's the maximization of a net happiness. So if you like, positive experiences that conscious beings have, the greatest possible surplus of that over pain and suffering and undesirable experiences that they have. Now that's a pretty crude way of putting it that goes back to Jeremy Bentham. We could obviously talk about that a lot more, whether that's quite the right way of putting it or not. And you could have other values. There are plenty of philosophers around who think, for instance, that things like freedom or knowledge or autonomy are good things in themselves, not just because they promote happiness. But I think in terms of practical consequences, for a lot of the things that I'm talking about, that's good enough. And in particular, I think it's important to focus on reducing the negatives, because I think that while there are certainly some things we can do to make people who are already reasonably happy even happier, it does seem to me that all the evidence is that it's much more cost effective to help people who are in very difficult circumstances. And this is basically the marginal utility idea that if, as one organization called Give Directly is doing, you give people who are earning maybe $300 a year, that's their total income, if you give them $1,000, you've made a huge difference to them. You've given them 3 years' income. They can do things that they couldn't do before, maybe buy some corrugated iron so that they live in a house where it doesn't rain in every time it rains. And, you know, that makes a much bigger difference for their family than $1,000 is likely to make to you. Whereas if you gave that to somebody who was as well off as you, well, they could do much less with it. So that's why I think in practice, if you do have the kind of hedonistic, you know, happiness, net surplus of happiness kind of view of good that I do, it makes sense to focus on reducing suffering rather than on increasing happiness. And I think probably for most of the goals or values or, you know, what it is that people would think to be good, that would generally be so. You know, if you want to think about human rights or something like that, you would think about helping people whose rights are being violated in the most grievous and egregious ways and therefore suffering the most from that, rather than people who are reasonably well off but have some rights violations. At least that's the way I would think about it.
What is next for you? What are your goals going forwards?
I'm hoping to continue to be helpful for the effective altruist movement. The next thing that I'm going to do in connection with that is I gave some lectures at Yale in April, series of three lectures called the Castle Lectures. I'm not sure that they're online yet. I think they did an audio recording or maybe a video recording, and they talked about putting it online, but nobody has told me that they've come online yet. But it's kind of, it's, if you like, it's a much longer version of the TED talk. Part of the deal of doing those lectures at Yale is that you give Yale University Press a book-length manuscript. So it'll be, so I need to write them up and refine them and do that. It'll be a shortish book, and I hope it'll be out sometime maybe in the second half of next year, but I'm not 100% sure I'll keep to that deadline. So that's one thing that I want to do. But I also just want to be talking and writing about the movement in smaller ways, you know, to various audiences who know probably generally less about it than you do, to student groups and other groups, and writing occasionally about it in op-ed kind of length as well. So that's one of my goals. I certainly want to keep doing research into what are the best things that we ought to be doing and how can we better think about that. I think there are interesting philosophical questions as well as empirical questions about trying to work these things out, how we look at the judgments of value. For example, I talked about how we compare animal suffering and human suffering, and there's a debate in the EA movement about priorities there too, about whether we can be more cost effective in trying to reduce animal suffering than we can human suffering at the moment. So those are questions that I have a keen interest in, and a practical as well as a philosophical interest, and I want to keep doing, want to keep looking at them too.
So you mentioned the usefulness of having global poverty as basically the public face of the EA movement, and having things like X-Risk and other related ideas being sort of, you introduced to people later. I do agree that it's useful to have a public face that is as comprehensible as possible at first glance. But I think it is not too difficult to craft a public image that's sort of a step between the two. When I was on the plane on the way here, I was talking to the person sitting next to me, was in high school, and he talked a bit about where he was from. He was interested in science earlier in his school career, but now he wanted to be a police officer so that he could help people. And I told him the story of Norman Borlaug, who developed we all know who Borlaug is. Okay. So all right. So told him a story about this guy who, first of all, has this really emotionally evocative story. He's just a really awesome character, and saved somewhere between 200 million and a billion lives. This random guy on the plane found that pretty compelling.
Right. Good. You saved him from the police force, maybe.
So I think, I don't know that there are particularly good actionable examples for people that aren't ready to gung ho go into science or go into launch a technological innovative startup or whatnot. So I don't know, but for people that are sort of in a dilettante way, just wanting somewhere to throw a few thousand dollars around, if there's a concrete action we can give them about that yet. But I feel like that's a reasonable goal for the next year, is find sort of mid-level suggestions to people that, like in the case of Borlaug, you have the exact same emotionally evocative image of the starving child in Asia or India or where have you. But it's accompanied with a much more empowering story, I think.
Oh, absolutely. No, look, I totally agree with that. And I wasn't suggesting we should only focus on individual children, because I think that can actually mean that we lose some highly cost-effective opportunities. Another good example that just comes to mind is, I don't know if any of you heard of Brian West, who's an effective altruist who's donating to developing in vitro meat, which is sort of, maybe it's a longish term thing, but it will, if it comes off, if it can be economical, it will have a huge effect both in reducing animal suffering and in reducing the contribution that livestock make to climate change, which is very significant.
Yeah.
So, I think there are many sort of easily conveyable ideas in science. If you have someone who's interested in going to science, say, why might you contribute to a scientific research idea that does have very high expected value.
Yes.
Thanks.
Do we have an opinion what might be more effective? A, convincing altruists to become effective altruists, or B, becoming non-altruists to become altruists and effective altruists?
I think it's very hard to convince people who don't actually have even, you know, the altruistic motivation. Who, you know, there are some people you talk about, I mean, happens more to me when I talk about the animal issue. There's quite a lot of people who say, look, I just don't really care about animals, you know, if they suffer, well, doesn't bother me, you know, I care about my other people. And there's a smaller number, but some people who say that about the distant poor as well, you know, look, I really care about my family and the people around me. And I find it very hard to move those people in a way. I think it's kind of, it's unfortunate, but it's sort of a waste of time to spend too much time on them. We might eventually win one over, but on the other hand, if people say, look, yeah, I do care about people who are living in poverty elsewhere in the world, or I care about animals, and I don't think that I can really do much about it. It's just, you know, a lot of people say, oh, it's such an immense problem, you know, what will I do? It's in the ocean or what? But I think, so those people are sort of altruistic but not acting on it. I think you can convince them, as I was saying, that there are effective things they can do, that they should be focusing on the difference they can make to specific individuals rather than on the total size of the problem. And that there are, you know, it's worthwhile getting into it. So if you're talking about dying people, I think you can move them into it. Yeah. But I do think also it is very important to talk to people who are already donating significant amounts, but not effectively. Perhaps that is really the lowest hanging fruit at this stage. And again, you know, not all of them are going to be easy to move either. There was a picture just over the weekend, I think, in the New York Times, but I don't know if some of you have seen that, about somebody who was talking about giving to train a guide dog for the blind. That happens to be an example that I use in the TED Talk about, you know, it's just for the cost of training one guide dog in the United States to help a blind person is something around $40,000. Depending a bit on how you calculate the costs, you could actually prevent hundreds or maybe thousands of people coming blind from conditions like trachoma in developing countries. So, you know, I found out pretty annoying actually when I look at it. You know, those are the kind of people that you would really like to reach and say something about. Couldn't you think a bit more about being more effective?
What is your current view on population ethics? So under what circumstances is it good to create new people?
The short philosophical answer to that is, I think if you can grab new people who will have good lives, so basically on balance happy lives in terms of what I said before, and will not have adverse effects on anyone else, that would be a good thing, anyone else, including on human animals. Now, that's not the world we're in, probably, right? I think that for various reasons, if you bring more people into existence, they may have positive lives, but they're likely to have a lot of negative effects on others. So my view of the present state of the world is that it's not a good thing in itself to bring more people into existence. And therefore, I think it's worth doing things that will reduce the number of people who come into existence, whether that's making contraception more easily available or providing education for girls, which has been shown to correlate inversely with the number of children that they will have, or even reducing child mortality seems to bring that. So that may be all the good things to do, given the way the world is at present. But otherwise, I do think it would be, in general, if there could be more people living happy lives. It's not that I'm against blind populations, per se. I don't think that there's any benefit in that. It's just that the present state of the world, I think, makes that a difficult thing to do. One other thing I might add to that, because I know some people who are very much concerned with global problems and are altruistic, assume that the implication of that is that I should have any children myself.
And I'm not sure that that is the implication. It could be, but I do worry a little bit about the sort of long-run effect of people who are intelligent, thoughtful altruists selecting not to have children. Whether you think that there's an influence through genetics or through upbringing, it may mean that there are fewer of such people in the population in future generations.
Before we take our next question, the connection seems to be going somewhat slow, so I'm going to quickly reset the call. So we're just going to call you back on Skype.
Okay, I'll give my technical assistant if he needs to do anything. He is.
Okay, I'll try video, and if not, I'll go to just audio. Can you hear us?
Any better now?
It appears to be the same. So, no. We're just hardwired, and this is the only one.
You're still on screen there, hardwired here.
It does look a little better. We're going to continue with video, and if the quality is too bad, we'll switch just to audio, since it's more important to hear voices.
Okay.
All right. Next question.
I have two questions that are related. So first, you wrote Famine, Affluence, and Morality in 1975, and The Life You Can Save in 2009. I'm curious, and The Life You Can Save, as I understand it, is essentially the same argument, but for a different audience. And so I'm curious to wonder what accounted for the period in between. So why did you write it in 1975 and then do the other one in 2009? And then also, it seems like the reception of both of the ideas, they were definitely presented in different communities, but the reception was very different in both of those time periods. And I'm curious to hear your hypothesis of why it maybe took longer for the ideas to disseminate into the larger population.
Right, okay. So the time I wrote Famine, Affluence, and Morality, there were two different causes that I was interested in, I've become aware of at about the same time. One is the global poverty issue and the other is the animal issue. I wrote Famine, Affluence, Morality as an article, relatively short article, didn't take me very long to write it. But when I thought about what should I be putting most of my time and effort and energy into now, answer seemed to me to be the animal movement. And this is something I'm thinking about in general, I'm glad you raised it. That's not because I thought that the animal movement in itself was necessarily a more important cause than the anti-poverty movement. It may be, but it may not be. I didn't really try to make that judgment. But what seemed to me clear was that at that time I could make a bigger contribution through the animal movement than I could through the anti-poverty movement. Because there were organizations already doing anti-poverty work, like Oxfam and other organizations. There were other people who were talking about it, maybe not quite in the way that I was in that article, but there were people who were interested in it. And the animal movement really had nobody with any kind of, I thought, you know, real, not only just not philosophical background, but really not much background that went beyond sentimental appeal to puppies and kittens cute, and shouldn't we stop being mean to them? And so I felt that by writing Animal Liberation, which was a bigger project, obviously a book, and then by getting involved in organizing organizations that could do this, I could make a bigger contribution than I could in the anti-poverty movement. Now that may explain why
for the next few years anyway. Can you hear me?
I can hear you, yeah.
Yeah, I'm just going to interrupt you for 1 second. If you can turn off your video, we'll leave ours on, and we think that that will improve the audio quality, but you'll still be able to see us.
Okay, great. All right.
Thanks.
Okay, tell me if that works. Sorry. I'm getting your audio fine, by the way, so it's just obviously.
Okay, great. Right. Yeah, I think this is better.
Good. Okay. So, I then thought, I did write more things about global poverty, but they were also articles or a chapter in my book, Practical Ethics. And, you know, in a way, to some extent, I felt, well, I put this out there,
But it's not getting a lot of response. It's getting discussion among philosophers, the articles being read by students because it was getting frequently reprinted in kinds of ethics anthologies that people use in teaching. But it wasn't really getting a lot of response because I suppose a lot of people thought that, well, that whole scene is too messy and, again, as I was saying, too corrupt. And during the whole of the Cold War era, a lot of aid was really political, going to, you know, the countries that are on our side. And I sort of started to feel a few years before I wrote The Life You Can Save, I started to feel that things were tipping there, that there was a lot more serious thought going into aid and how it could be made effective. There was more serious discussion of making it effective, of assessing its effectiveness too, you know, trying to do proper trials to tell whether it was effective or not. There was this new work going on that Esther Duflo and Abhijit Banerjee were doing with the Poverty Action Lab at MIT, and then and GiveWell got set up, though I think I only heard about them when I was already writing the book. I sort of felt, you know, now is the time to write something on this issue and to try to reach the broader public. Because as you said, Famine, Affluence, and Morality was published in a philosophy journal. It got anthologized, but it never really got out of that sort of university scene in some way, the philosophy scene. Then I guess the other thing that's relevant to this is I took my position at Princeton in 99, and some of my opponents, who were my opponents more for my views about euthanasia and bioethics than anything that we've been talking about, did me a favor by protesting the appointment, picketing Princeton and so on. And that got me a lot of publicity and got me an invitation by the New York Times Sunday Magazine to write something for them. And I wrote a piece that was called The Singer Solution to Global Poverty. That was their title, I should say, not mine. A bit hubristic, but that had quite a lot of resonance. So that was, in a way, perhaps the first big piece that I wrote for a mass audience on that topic, a general audience. And it got a lot of response. I think they said they had 800 letters or something written in response, which in those pre-web days, or sort of pre-web days, was a huge number of people actually writing in. So I suppose it's from that time on, perhaps, I started thinking about doing a book, but it did still take a few years for me to actually write it. And the response, you asked about the difference in response. So the response, I think, has been much better and much stronger. And I would attribute that to the fact that there's much more information there about aid, that people are thinking more seriously about it. And also I think that even at the government level, people are making more of an effort to make aid effective, to avoid just giving aid to corrupt dictators because they'll be on our side of the Cold War. Obviously, that doesn't really apply anymore. So I think the climate there is much better for getting people to think positively about aid.
Okay, before we take new questions, if anyone, previous question they felt wasn't answered because they weren't able to decipher anything, I want to give them a quick chance to ask for a clarification. You need to clarify?
Yeah.
Okay, so let's ask you a question one more time.
I didn't get the answer on the question whether we should have altruists become effective altruists or convert non-altruists at all.
So now I'm not sure whether you simply want me to repeat what I said because the audio was not audible.
Yeah, exactly. If you wouldn't mind repeating, that would be great.
Okay, sorry.
Also,
yeah.
Thank you.
That's okay. It's okay. So my answer was that I guess I divided people into really three categories. You have two categories, but I'm suggesting that there are some people who are just not altruistic at all in their motivations. People who, when you talk to them about the suffering either of animals or of the poor, just say, "I don't care, just leave me alone. I just want to get on with enjoying my life and maybe looking after people I love and care about. I don't care about animals. I don't care about people in Africa." I find, in my experience, that they're too hard to work with. Too much effort required to get them to do anything positive. I'd say, at least for the moment, ignore them, try and isolate them, but forget about it. So then you have people who are altruistic in their motivation, but think that I can't really do anything. The problems are so huge, they're overwhelming. What can I do? I'm just one individual, it's hopeless. Or, you know, people who think, well, the aid organizations are all corrupt and it's not going to help. So them, I think you can make good progress with, because you know there is a good empirical case for showing that even if there are some bad aid organizations, even if the problem is huge and they can't solve it all, they can make a difference to specific people or specific animals. They can prevent suffering. They can prevent premature death. And so I think you can get them to contribute. But probably the easiest, probably the real low-hanging fruit here is people who are already giving, but are giving ineffectively. People who are, say, are giving, I think I mentioned people who are giving to the local children's hospital because when their child was sick, the children's hospital did a great job of looking after their child. But, you know, they're living in Palo Alto or somewhere. It's already one of the best hospitals in the world. You know, the cost per life saved is over $1 million or whatever. And I think for those people, you know, to point out that, look, you can save a life somewhere of for $1,000 or a couple of $1,000 is probably the most effective thing to do at the moment.
So, given the example of Norman Borlaug, is research more cost-effective than, for example, the Against Malaria Foundation? Borlaug's result would cost $1 or $2 trillion at AMF's prices.
I think it. Look, I don't really know the answer. I can't do that calculation. But to some extent, to me, it depends on your tolerance of risk. I think if you give to research, it's quite likely that your money will do no good at all, that, you know, it will be put towards something that turns out to be a complete dead end that isn't positive. Whereas if you give to the Against Malaria Foundation, I think it's extremely likely that your money will do some significant good, will save one or more lives. You know, how you calculate whether, in fact, well, yes, you know, I have a 1 in a million chance of saving 1 million lives by giving the same sort of amount of money that would save one life if I give it to Against Malaria Foundation, in which case, you know, if that's the odds, then the expected value is about the same. Or if you say, I have a 1 in a million chance of saving 10 million lives, then now the expected value is higher with going into research. I don't know how we can really decide that in advance. Obviously, you know, the people who supported Norman Borlaug's research got extraordinarily good value for money. But was that predictable at the start? Not entirely, but, you know, what could they say about expected value? That's one of the things that I think would be good to have more people looking at to see if we can get a better handle on it. But again, it relates a bit to what I was saying about the public face of things. I think people would be, you know, ready to say, if you say, look, for $1,000 or $2,000, you can save a child's life, a lot of people would be willing to say that's good value. If you say for $2,000, there's a 1 in a million chance that you could save 10 million people's lives, I think people are, oh, you know, well, so you mean there's 999,999 chances out of a million that it'll do no good at all? And you say, yes, I'm sorry, that's the odds. A lot of people will say, no, I'm not going to give.
Eliezer Yudkowsky here. I'm a subjective expected utility maximizer, and I behave like an aggregate utilitarian with respect to our local galaxies. I want to sort of like try and ask a relatively sort of pinpoint question here. In my own reasoning, I usually try to make a sort of very sharp principled question, distinction between the questions of what is actually true in the real world and what can I explain to which audience. Part of the way I form that principled distinction is I ask myself, if this is true, how would I explain it? So, like, if I imagine, what if it's true about effective altruism that in the end, when the history books are written, it turns out that all of the net impact, like essentially all of the net impact from effective altruism, came from it successfully propagating by telling the global poverty story, but 1% of the people it propagated to ended up aiding a scientific or technological project. Like, if I imagine that if you told me that exact fact, I'd probably keep the global poverty story on the front page, and then there'd be a link to the math behind the argument, and then that would have a link to science and technology, a risky thing of higher expected utility. Mm-hmm. And you continue to propagate through the poverty argument, but you'd on the side go through the science and technology thing. So my question is either, do you disagree with what I just said, in which case we should discuss that? Or if you agree with it, what do you think about the pure facts of the astronomical waste, astronomical benefit argument?
Okay. Good. Yeah, that was very nicely put, I think. And I do agree with what you said, right? I do agree that I think, you want to expand the number of people who are receptive to the idea of effective altruism, and a small percentage of them will start to think about other forms of effective altruism and what is really the best way to do. Now, so what do I think about the astronomical waste argument? So has this been discussed, by the way, that you, do other people know what... Sorry, I didn't hear the answer.
It hasn't been discussed yet, but they asked for a quick summary. So the very basic idea is you got all these galaxies within range of the telescopes that aren't going to go over the cosmological horizon by the time you reach them. So in the end, if you value future experiences at all, most of the impact that we have on the net good of reality is the impact we have on future galaxies, and in particular, does humanity survive to colonize them? Are they colonized by good people? There's just no way anything on the Earth can compete with all those galaxies, is the sort of rough idea there.
Right. So, yeah, and just to add to that a little bit, so there's an Oxford philosopher called Nick Bostrom who has a paper using that title, and he has these enormous numbers in it about, you know, if we had a billion people living for a billion years, or maybe even imagines we develop ways of having vastly larger populations because maybe we can embody minds in software or something like that. So you have these vast numbers of people who are living very happy lives for vast numbers of time. And then he comes out with something that says something like, so even if you only have... and obviously, for this to happen, our species needs to survive for the next whatever it will take, century or two, for us to develop the technology to colonize these other inhabitable planets in other galaxies. So if you can do something that reduces the risk of human extinction during that sort of century or two bottleneck period, by even, a billionth of 1%, that would still do a lot more good than anything that you might do in terms of reducing global poverty or a lot of other issues today. So I think it's a very ingenious argument. I have a lot of respect for Nick Bostrom. He's a very smart guy, no question about that. I find the figures a little hard to credit, really, how those calculations are achieved. And, you know, it's very... that you've excluded various other things that might happen, that might go wrong. It just kind of assumes optimistically that you know, once we have better technology, then we'll know how to make everything great. So I'm somewhat skeptical about the actual calculations. But I do think, and one other thing that I ought to say is, a lot of people do jib at the idea that it's as important to produce more happy beings in future, which is what we're talking about, as it is to reduce the suffering of a being who's existing right now. And that's a difficult philosophical question, actually. Bostrom is assuming that it is for most of what he does. He does consider other possibilities at the end of the paper. There could be a philosophical difference there, too. But I think the argument is intriguing. I do actually tend to agree that reducing X risk is extremely important and is worth thinking about, particularly where we have a good sense of what will reduce X risk. And that's why I'm a little more sympathetic to money going into the asteroid deflection program than I am to some of the other things where it's really harder to know that we're making a difference in the right direction by what we do at this stage. But I certainly do think that, X-risk is a significant part of EA, and it's a very good thing if a proportion of the people who are in EA start to think really seriously about that and about how to make a difference. I'm just looking at the time, and I think I'm going to have to wind up because I do have another commitment that I have to go to. So I've enjoyed the discussion. I hope that you have. I'm sorry if there are other people who would have liked to ask questions at some time, but I do have to wind up.
So I guess I think I speak for everyone here when I say we really appreciate your time. It was a really inspiring talk. Hopefully you can connect with whomever still has questions. And thank you. You've done really inspiring work.
Great. All right.